This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat. My name is Marla Damati. Today on the show here at the ABC, we're talking about your mental health this week because it's been an incredibly tough year for everyone, not just here in Australia, but globally, and we're only halfway through. Coming up soon, you'll hear from a professor who spent the past year researching the mental health of Pacifica communities across Australia. And what is e-waste and how much does the Pacific produce? In just over 30 minutes, you'll find out and hint it's kilos and kilos. And we'll talk about how the Pacific can better manage it and what's at stake if we don't. But next, now that Australia's borders has been closed for months because of COVID-19, kava stocks here in Australia are running low. There's now a push from the Pacifica community who want the Australian government to make some special allowances. Those stories and more coming up on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
There are calls for the Australian government to temporarily relax rules that allows Pacific Islanders to bring kava into the country. Almost 2,000 people have signed an online petition, hoping they can be allowed to import the calming drink, which has significant cultural value to many Pacific Islanders. But the border closures and travel restrictions due to COVID-19 is affecting the supply of fresh kava for personal consumption in Australia. And according to petitioners, it's threatening their heritage. The Australian government was meant to be working on plans for a commercial kava import trial this year, but now that's been delayed. Reporter Kelvin Anthony has the story.
Those petitioning the Australian government say kava is used in religious and cultural events that strengthen family, community and social cohesion. And they say that social cohesion is needed now more than ever amid a global health crisis. Sakeasi Tawaketini is from the Brisbane Fijian community.
The petition is quite a platform for Australian Fijians to voice their need or concern, hoping that the government will just temporarily relax the restrictions.
Mr. Tawaketini is among thousands of petitioners who are calling on the Australian government to ease restrictions on kava imports. The coronavirus pandemic means that they can't enjoy the brew as they normally would, and with travel bans in place, they won't be bringing kava home from the Pacific anytime soon. He says the kava ceremony is an important cultural protocol when welcoming visitors.
I can say it's a passport for you in order for you to enter their territory. And we call it in Fiji as Sebuchev. We as Fijian, we can't live without it. It's part of our life. And we live in a country that respects our traditions and cultures. And I think the government should look into it.
Kava is a traditional beverage made by crushing the roots of the kava plant and mixing it with water to get a brownish drink that has relaxing effects. But it's not just that. For some Pacific countries, it is part of their identity and key life events like birthdays, weddings, funerals, and other traditional ceremonies. It's hard to imagine a community function without it.
So if you any traditional gathering happening, kava is part of the protocol. For example, a newborn baby in Australia from Fijian Connection will have to expect that people will be visiting you over. And visiting over, you have to present kava to them in token of appreciation.
As part of the Pacific Step Up, the Australian government announced last year it will begin a commercial import trial by the end of this year, news which has been welcomed by Pacific kava exporters from across the region. According to Zane Yoshida, the managing director of Kava Fiji Limited, Pacific kava exports has the potential to become a multi-billion dollar industry. While speaking at the University of the South Pacific in February, he said,
"If you consider the price of kava today, the potential upside with a more regulated industry to give Western consumers confidence in the therapeutic benefits of kava for treating various disorders, to go up against pharmaceutical companies for the treatment and alleviation of anxiety, insomnia and pain. Collectively, we are looking at a $200 billion opportunity."
Australia also announced that Pacific Islanders and kava enthusiasts would be allowed to legally bring in 4 kilograms of kava powder for personal consumption into the country. an increase from the 2 kilogram limit. But with international travel not returning to pre-COVID-19 levels anytime soon, it means people cannot bring back kava from the islands until the situation changes. It can only be imported through freight flights, and any ordinary person wanting to import will need an import license.
The freight is quite high now, but the demand is still there. I'm still receiving orders coming in.
Sakiusa Sorovi, the owner of Sorovi Kava in Fiji, has been in the kava business for the last 30 years. He exports the commodity from Pacific Island countries to as far as the United States. He says profits from his business has almost halved due to COVID-19.
50% of my total revenue is gone. It's going but twinkling now, it's not like before.
Mr. Sorovi says he was looking forward to Australia opening commercial kava imports later this year to help local businesses. Pacific Beat sought comment from the Australian government about the pilot program. In a statement, the Therapeutic Goods Administration spokesperson said,
"The Australian government response to COVID-19 is a priority for the Department of Health. However, development work on the kava commercial importation pilot is continuing, taking into consideration that full implementation and further targeted consultation is unlikely to occur until travel restrictions are fully lifted."
The spokesperson added,
"This means the pilot is unlikely to commence until 2021. Further information about the pilot will be published on the Office of Drug Control website when it becomes available."
So the Pacific kava industry will need to wait a bit longer. But Sakiusa Sorovi, the director of Sorovi Kava, remains positive it will work out eventually.
"It's a good idea because compared to other drugs, this is a natural herb. I think it's good for us. So once COVID is gone, then open up the market. Kava is a coming sedative. It calms you down. A lot of people are being terrorized by this COVID thing. I think the best medicine is kava."
Fijian kava exporter Sakiusa Sorovi ending that report by Calvin Anthony.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The coronavirus pandemic and the 24-hour news cycle, which is often has a lot of bleak news, can take its toll on people's mental health. So this week across the ABC, we're looking at that issue and what can be done. It's Your Mental Health Week. Now, today I wanted to look at what are some of the big mental health issues facing the Pacifica communities here in Australia. Giorgi Ravulo is an associate professor at the University of Wollongong and has spent the last year researching the mental health of Pacifica populations in the country. His research look specifically at three main topics: the prevalence of mental illness in Pacific Islander populations, the impact of mental illness, and how to promote opportunities to address these issues. To talk more about this, he joins me this morning. Good morning, Giorgi.
Good morning.
Now, firstly, how prevalent is mental illness among Pacific Islander people here in Australia?
Well, part of our research was to understand what are some of the significant symptoms that Pacific people might be showing when it comes to the possibility of having a mental illness. And we found quite uniquely from our research data that there might be certain symptoms that might be perceived as something completely different and might actually be a mental illness or might lead to a mental illness. So part of our research was very much looking at how we can better recognise certain common mental disorders amongst our communities.
So what are some of the unique key symptoms that you've found in your research for Pacifica people when it comes to mental illness?
So some of the symptoms that we saw, for example, if someone may have found it difficult to enjoy their daily activities or unable to find a useful part in life or have lost interest in things or even feeling like a worthless person, these sort of symptoms may lend itself to the possibility of the person possibly having depression. We also found that if they were easily frightened or feeling nervous, tense or worried or having trouble thinking, this may be symptoms for a Pacific person that may have anxiety. So these particular symptoms help us for the first time understand what are some of the common symptoms that may be evident or prevalent amongst our Pacific people.
Now, your research has been done during the COVID-19 pandemic. Have you seen an impact from the pandemic or its restrictions even on the mental health of these communities?
One of the strengths I think we as Pacific people have is our communal and collective approach to everything. So I think this has helped us to navigate COVID-19 in a way that has been helpful. However, access to resources that generally we might have taken for granted are not as readily available. This includes employment opportunities and other activities that assist with our well-being. So this is something that we are still trying to understand what the impacts of that, including access to Centrelink benefits here in Australia, especially for Pacific people that may have come via New Zealand or from the islands directly and may not be eligible for such support, especially if their workplace is not eligible for JobKeeper. So those sort of elements still need to be understood more broadly and the impact. But I think, again, our approach as being collectively oriented has helped us to manage COVID in a way that is helpful.
Now, one of the big issues that you came across in your research is how mental illness and mental health is perceived in the Pacifica communities. Can you tell me a little bit more about this?
Generally, from a Pacific point of view, we've traditionally seen mental illnesses as more of a spiritual concern rather than a health concern. And I think there's a relationship between the two. I think it's possible for us to understand mental illness more broadly, and that's something that this research strives to do. It strives to understand some of those specific perspectives, and it helps us to also understand how we might use certain language or phrases to further understand what mental illnesses are. So part of our research was to develop a Pacific mental health lexicon, a Pacific Indigenous mental health lexicon. And we've been working with psychiatrists and doctors and other mental health professionals across Fiji, Tonga, Samoa and Vanuatu to develop phrasing or terminology that better enhances the way in which we understand mental illness. Because traditionally, again, we've generally used phrasing that might be more negative or creates more stereotypes and labels. So this Pacific Indigenous Mental Health Lexicon helps us to further understand what mental illnesses might mean and what they might actually be for people.
And it's also quite important as well to have culturally appropriate, like you said, lexicon languages to get to that community. But in saying that, what are some potentially culturally appropriate solutions that we can find for these issues and, you know, how these issues can be addressed?
Completely agree with you. One of our biggest emphasis also from the research and our recommendations, which will be out in the next couple of months, is for services, for the workforce themselves to be more collaborative in their approach in working with Pacific communities. I think it's important that we definitely educate our communities to better access services. But once they are accessing those services, how do those services proactively respond and collaborate and culturally nuance their service delivery in a way that is helpful for our communities?
Now, how important is it as well to acknowledge the intercultural differences that are at play? We talked about, you know, culturally appropriate, but, you know, when it comes to dealing with mental illness in Pacifica communities and Pacifica diaspora here in Australia?
Yeah, look, that's something that's very, very important for us to understand as well. I think that when we come from different, diverse ethnic communities, we bring a whole heap of differences. And I think part of our health systems approach, but even our education system, our legal system, other systems that we interact as diaspora here in Australia or in Aotearoa, it's important that they are part of developing systems that better respond to those differences, those diverse needs. So it's very, very important those intercultural differences are understood and utilised in a proactive way.
Georgie, thank you so much for joining me this morning and chatting about mental health in Pacifica communities here in Australia.
Thanks for having me.
That was Georgie Ravulo, an associate professor at the University of Wollongong, speaking with me there about his research into mental health of Pacific Islander communities here in Australia. And if after this discussion has raised any issues for you in Australia, you can contact the Lifeline Crisis Support on 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. And whether you are in Australia or in the Pacific region, you can find more information on beyondblue.org. lifeline.org.au and lifeline.org.au. All this week, the ABC will share tips, strategies and stories across TV, radio and online, focusing on supporting your mental health and well-being. Sometimes a small change can make a big difference, so head on over to abc.net.au to find out more about ABC Your Mental Health.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now let's have a little bit of music. This is Mejigin, Baker Boy featuring Jespy.
Music is the Mejigin. These beats got us out of control. Dance around like you never get old. Breaking and popping on my boys, pop locking. Got us feeling like we out of this world. Drink your mask, get the young one, ballet, like a goring, a lego. Go hard, never lay back, lay back. Too real, can't fake that, fake that. Smile for the gram, like take that, take that. Shout out to the OGs, like way back, way back. You got stage fright? No problem. You got neck brace? No problem. You got two left feet, can't catch that beat. Take a deep breath, cause I got this, yo.
If you're driven for the vision, then I'm down to ride. Whether be dropped there, me, you'll find. And we still in the city, but the crowd gone wild. Yeah, keep it banging through the system. Light it up, start it up like an engine. Bars on lock, put the music freedom. And the booty drum, go put up a bump bump. Hey, okay, yeah, come. I give you some of this, make it jump. Do it just to do it, and I do it till it's done. Connect with the sound, people over income. That's team, that's squad, get the picture. That's us, that's mob, if you with us. Just be, yeah, the queen is in the building. Knocking at the kingdom, yeah.
Okay, is it with us? Yeah, okay, is it with us?
Just be, yeah, the queen is in the building. You better come correct if you're knocking at the kingdom.
In times like these, music really can be the medicine. That was Mejigin by Baker Boy featuring Jespy. For the latest weather update from across the region, I am joined by Neville Coop, the director of Ngandraki Weather. Good morning, Neville.
Yeah, hi, Marla.
There's still a bit of weather around Fiji and Tonga, it seems.
Yeah, that's right. It's all happening right now. Well, we have a very broad band of cloud that stretches from back towards the Solomons down across northern parts of Vanuatu, then over Fiji and Tonga. And that cloud is thickening up a bit now and will probably bring quite a bit of weather to Fiji and the southern parts of Tonga today. Already seeing reports of showers and storms from Nuku'alofa, and we're likely to see some rain spread across the western part of Fiji by the middle of the day and then further east by tonight. So elsewhere it's looking pretty good, east of the dateline. Niue, Samoa and the Cooks all looking pretty bright and sunny today, right the way across to French Polynesia. There are a couple of thunderstorms popping up about the Solomons. And PNG is looking pretty good too. Moresby should be clear and sunny again today as well. So weather's been driven mostly by a very deep low, which is right over the North Island of New Zealand. So spare a thought for our friends to the south who are going through a pretty rough time of it lately with winter, so our Kiwi friends can expect more of that over the next few days.
Definitely having our thoughts with our Kiwi friends. Neville, we know that you enjoy watching the stars and keeping across celestial movements, and I hear a whisper that last night the Moon, Jupiter and Saturn all lined up.
Yes, look, this is something that's actually occurred over the last few days, actually, going back to the weekend. The full moon was, from memory, I think on Saturday last weekend, and it was particularly spectacular then. The moon was, when it rose, was sitting just above Jupiter and Saturn. So the moon's going through its normal cycle right now, and so it's not quite as brilliant as you would otherwise see, but Jupiter and Saturn are still very much prominent in the sky and can be seen with the naked eye. You don't have any problems with that if you know where to look. So you will see some interesting things in the sky if you care to look up every now and then. And last weekend, and probably today, tonight, it'll start to sort of become less spectacular than it was, say, a few days ago.
Well, I'll definitely head outside tonight and have a look for myself. Neville, thank you so much for bringing us the weather updates from across the region.
Okay, you're welcome.
That was Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather, giving us the latest weather updates from across the region. And for weather updates, you can head to Facebook and search Nandraki Weather, spelled Nadraki. It's now time for news from across the region and the world, and to bring it to us today is Jordan Fennell. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Marla.
Now, Jordan, let's go to coronavirus updates in the region, because Fiji has confirmed a new case of COVID-19. What's the latest on this?
That's right. So yesterday we brought you the news of Fiji's first coronavirus case in more than 2 months, which was a 66-year-old man who had just returned from India. And the Fiji Times is now reporting that that man's son has now tested positive, and also a 36-year-old woman has tested positive as well. And both the son and the 36-year-old woman were also on that flight that had returned from India to Fiji. All those three new cases now together, they're considered border quarantine cases, and all three of them are in isolation. And the rest of the 105 passengers that were on board that plane from India to Fiji are now being tested today.
So it'll be really interesting to see whether or not Fiji does record a few more cases now with the testing of these passengers. But staying on coronavirus, Brazil's president, who has been a COVID-19 skeptic himself, has now actually tested positive for COVID-19. Can you tell us a bit more?
I know. Yeah, it's very interesting. Jair Bolsonaro has said that he has now tested positive for COVID-19, like you said. After months of downplaying the virus, he's drawn a lot of criticism across the world from public health experts for fighting Brazil's state and city efforts to put in place social distancing measures. He's really fought against that. He's also fired two of his health ministers, both who were doctors, and he's also defied court orders in Brazil to wear a mask in public.
It's just, you know, if you actually head onto your search engines and type in Jair Bolsonaro, you'll see the photos that, you know, he has posted of himself in hospital. It doesn't look great. You know, the virus is quite hard on some people. And look, it's pretty incredible that he's remained a skeptic for so long, considering Brazil actually has the world's second largest outbreak with 1.6 million confirmed cases. It's just...
it's really hitting Brazil really, really hard. And since about March, you know, when it really, you know, the coronavirus stormed across the world, I guess, there were many reports of people in Brazil having to just leave their dead out on the streets, hospitals overflowing. It's currently killed more than 65,000 people in Brazil. So, you know, quite crazy that their own president really downplayed it for such a long time.
Well, in downplaying it, do we know how he's feeling at the moment? You know, what state he's in?
Yeah, so he gave a press conference yesterday and he was wearing a mask. So for the first time, he'd popped a mask on after developing those symptoms. He said that over the weekend, he had developed the symptoms of feeling exhausted, feeling achy, and also he had a fever. But he was well enough to at least stand in front of reporters and talk to people yesterday. He told reporters as well that he is taking hydroxychloroquine, which is that controversial anti-malarial drug that Donald Trump has often spruiked in his press conferences as well. But a Reuters report still says, you know, that hydroxychloroquine has unproven effectiveness against COVID-19.
That was a great segue because our next story does mention Donald Trump. Jordan, speaking of, you know, the US president, he has suggested banning the popular social media app TikTok from the United States. We know this app is used quite predominantly here, you know, in Australia, in the US, and even in the Pacific as well. Why is he doing this?
Yeah, really interesting development with TikTok. And like you said, it's such a widely used app. I read actually that since the start of the year, it's been downloaded 315 million times. And CNN is reporting that the Trump administration is looking at banning a range of Chinese social media apps, including TikTok, over security concerns, because TikTok is owned by a Beijing company called ByteDance that has been repeatedly criticized by US politicians of being a threat to national security because of its ties to China. However, TikTok has responded by saying that the app is actually led by an American CEO and says that US data in particular is actually stored in the US with a backup in Singapore. So they say there are no ties to China, but the US is saying that there is.
You know what? It's actually quite interesting as well, because over the weekend, I saw reports that a researcher who claimed to have reverse engineered the app itself revealed that TikTok was actually radically invading privacy, tracking memory usage, the other apps you've installed, Wi-Fi access and IP addresses as well, which is quite concerning.
Yeah, I also saw those reports across the weekend. I actually think it was initially reported back in April, but it's gained traction again just recently. And, you know, it is interesting because, so I have TikTok. I have the app. I do peruse it probably every day, actually. And I've also learned TikTok dances here at Pacific Beat. Presenter and producer Talia Olatia and I have made TikTok dances. You have as well, Marla. And these days, I really just assume that most of my apps are tracking my data, to be honest. And I don't read the privacy policies of any of the apps that I use.
What do you mean you don't read the T and C's?
I do not. They're so long. And I really just assume that they're all taking my data, to be honest. So I don't know in particular how far particular apps are digging for data. But it is obviously concerning to have all that information being relayed back to different governments. So I guess the question is, you know, with TikTok and all apps potentially, you know, which ones do we have to get rid of, if any, and should we?
Well, that's a really great question. And, you know, it reminds me of when the Facetune aging app became really popular. And, you know, where you took a photo of yourself and it either made you really young or really old. And then it was revealed that it's actually a Russian organization or a Russian app maker that made it. And your, you know, information could be leaked to, you know, the Russian government. I think it's a really interesting and important conversation to have about digital literacy and how much information we actually give to the apps that we download on our phones, on our, you know, laptops, on our tablets, because, you know, we really don't have much of an idea of what information goes into these places.
It's true. And like you say, with privacy policies, they're often so long that people do never read them and skip through them. And if you are a person that does read them, you know, I'm very impressed. but maybe there has to be something there as well, where it's like when you first install an app, there are like an abbreviated version of the privacy policy where it hits you with like the three main points of what data it's actually going to take to make sure that you're okay with it.
I think that potentially could be a good idea. But, you know, speaking of technology, although it's not apps, coming up very soon on the program, we will be talking about Pacific e-waste, which is the waste that is produced by phones and tablets and laptops. So stick around for that. But Jordan, thank you so much for bringing us the news from across the region.
No worries.
That was Jordan Fennell bringing us the news from the Pacific and across the world.
Pacific Beat at 6am and 7am weekdays on Radio Australia.
Many Indigenous Pacific cultures have hierarchies. Your chief is the most senior and respected person in the village, for example. But when it comes to social media sites like Facebook and Instagram, who and what is the Indigenous authority?
Our engagement with social media, specifically Facebook and Instagram, but also Twitter, fragments what we understand to be traditional forms of communication and hierarchical authority. Because we are dealing with multiple contexts and multiple time zones, collapsed contexts online, it makes it really hard to kind of regulate how people communicate with each other and to build protocols around how people can do that safely and respectfully.
Pacific Beat, 6am and 7am weekdays on Radio Australia.
That's right, you're listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Marla Damati. A UK NGO whose damning report on the deaths of fisheries observers was this week labelled a smear campaign, says its critics are trying to distract from the report's findings. Nine observers have died or disappeared at sea in the past 5 years, and the NGO Human Rights at Sea is calling for major industry reforms in the Pacific. But the other parties to the Nauru Agreement, the PNA, which is made up of 8 Pacific tuna countries and looks after 30% of global tuna stocks, says the report is misleading and parts of it are incorrect. Maurice Brown John is the PNA's commercial manager, and this is what he told Pacific Beat earlier.
This report suggests they are all deaths by suspicious circumstances, quoting NGO groups who have not been personally informed of the outcomes. That does not mean that they have not been properly investigated by Pacific Island or by US authorities. That is totally misleading.
The PNA allege the report is part of a smear campaign because it was sponsored by Worldwise Food, a UK company involved in pole and line fishing in the Maldives and whose products compete with Pacific Tuna. They say the company's owner has been involved in a number of high-profile legal challenges against it. But David Hammond, the CEO of Human Rights at Sea, has rejected the allegations. He spoke with reporter Evan Wasuka, and they began talking about the report's funding.
It was with unrestricted funds, and in a contract between us made it very clear that Human Rights at Sea had full editorial independence, and therefore there was no undue influence on us in this report. The key headlines are that there was never any conflict of interest. Any commercial issues that were ongoing or have been previously ongoing with Worldwise Foods and any other entities simply do not factor into this report. And at no time whatsoever has any undue pressure been put on Human Rights at Sea to write anything or draft anything or investigate anything that is not in line with the charity's objectives.
Worldwide Foods has had a past history with PNA and they've been involved in several legal cases. Weren't these factors that came up before Human Rights at Sea accepted the funding?
Those were previous factors that had absolutely nothing to do with the current piece of work. And I think it's really important that we make it clear that what's being alleged now by other parties and other stakeholders is simply a well-known commercial distraction technique taking away from the actual aim and objective of the report, which is to ensure support to the dependents of observers and crew lost at sea, and to make sure that their human rights or an observer's human rights are protected, certainly in the extremist cases of observers being lost at sea through unlawful acts.
There were some issues raised in the report by the Marine Stewardship Council. They say that, well, in the report it says 5 MSC-certified trips involved observer deaths. They're saying that's not the case and it was only the last with the Kiribati observer. Is there inaccuracies in the report?
As far as we are aware, there are no inaccuracies because MSC in this specific case was put on notice not just 48 hours beforehand, but we had discussed the issues with them prior to them having an advanced copy of the report. And at no time did any stakeholder who received the report in advance, so that we were being incredibly fair to those stakeholders for their right of reply, did they come back and highlight any issue to us in writing. And indeed, at the time of this interview, MSC has still not come back to challenge any of the facts in the report.
Are you concerned that issues around the sponsorship would cloud the findings of this report?
No. And the reason we say that is that issues of sponsorship, again, is a simple distraction technique. Your listeners actually want to hear what the truth is, what's happening on the ground and out at sea, to effectively shoot the messenger in order to reduce the effectiveness of the message.
Coming on to the report's recommendations, how would they change things better for observers? What do you think is the key recommendation? What do you think is the priority to make change happen?
In our position, the issue of transparency of investigations is one of the key priorities for this report to be effective and for it to be engaged with in the correct manner. We see the ability to have both civil society, the families, and any other interested parties' ability to understand what is happening within any fishery, given fishery, including those who are certified by the likes of MSC, to have open and free access, to be absolutely key, as also a deterrent effect.
So what happens now with the report? The report's done. How do you move it further and get these changes happening?
Well, I'm very pleased to be able to report that 96 hours after the report has gone out, that we've received direct responses from both P&A, from Maurice Brownjohn, and also from MSC, from their CEO, Rupert Howes, asking to engage directly with Human Rights at Sea. So already this is a very positive step forward, and we'd like to acknowledge that. Equally, we have had continued support from Mr. Burton, who has acted from our position with integrity in this case. And we are aiming that we can get all stakeholders around the table to collectively discuss the recommendations of the report and take that forward, as opposed to getting involved with any contentious business or commercial discussions.
David Hammond, CEO of Human Rights at Sea, speaking to Pacific Beat's Evan Masuka.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Here are some big numbers for you. Last year, 3.6 million tonnes of e-waste was dumped or burned globally. Now, that's equivalent to 350 cruise ships. And in our region, Oceania, each person generated 16.1 kilograms of e-waste. That's old mobile phones, batteries, TVs, computers, tablets, anything really with a battery or a plug. Now, that's according to a new UN report that puts Oceania, in fact, in second place for the highest amount of e-waste created per person. And based on those figures, the future isn't looking so great either. The report predicts that the world will reach 74 million tonnes of e-waste by 2030, almost double in 16 years. Now, it's a problematic issue for everyone, but in the Pacific, where in many countries, there quite literally isn't the space for all this dumped technology, problems are looming. Now, the region's peak environment body, SPREP, is working on several projects to tackle the issue. And for more, we're joined now from Samoa by Bradley Nolan, who's the project manager for Pack Waste Plus. Good morning, Talofa, Bradley.
Talofa.
Now, firstly, let's start by looking at more of these numbers in the report, because we should note that Oceania actually includes Australia and New Zealand as well as Pacific countries. And it turns out they're actually the ones who are really dumping lots of old phones and computers. On average, people like me who are here in Australia apparently create 21.3 kilos of e-waste.
Yeah, I think it's a really important distinction. The metropolitan countries in Oceania will by far create most of the e-waste that we're experiencing. The advent of the biennial update of mobile phones, the introduction of the flat screen TVs into LEDs, into plasmas, our disposable society, and large incomes really makes it quite easy for people these days to create new material without really thinking about what happens with the material that that is left over and how that actually gets recovered. And we need to recognise that e-waste is a really interesting product in the fact that a lot of the materials go into it have rare earth metals, which are found in some of the poorest countries and in some of the most pristine environments. So to actually mine this stuff is creating huge environmental issues. And then it's classed as a hazardous waste when it gets disposed. So there are some significant issues if it's left out into the environment, if it goes into landfill, if it hits those acidic and anaerobic environments and starts releasing those chemicals. So proper management of e-waste and really thinking about what we need and when we need it, vitally important. As you point out, in the islands, the availability of space, the technology to actually capture and the cost to make sure that this is dealt with properly are significant issues.
Talking about Pacific countries, the report found people in Samoa and Tonga throw away the most, which is 3.1 kilos each, followed by Micronesian countries and then Fiji and then PNG, where the report says it's about 1.5 kilos per person. Are these figures what you would expect?
Look, they're very interesting, and I'd love to dive into some of the raw data to really understand what's driving it. But the countries that are noted as collecting or creating some of those largest wastes do have large or well-structured government systems, education systems, and do attract a lot of expatriates from throughout the region. So it's unsurprising that there is a lot of technology that is coming into these islands that has to be dealt with when it comes to the end of its useful life. I'd also note a lot of those countries also receive aid, and there has been some incidents where some of the metropolitan countries, when some of their products are at the end of their useful life, say in a government department, has gifted those to countries to help out. But of course, they've got less life, so they become an instant e-waste problem when they hit the islands as well. So, the aid and the work that people are attempting to do, often with great intentions, creates some significant problems at the other end.
So why are we throwing so much of our old technologies away?
I think, as I mentioned earlier, the big issue is these things are designed for obsolescence in many ways. Technology is changing so quickly, and there is a significant industry out there that is all about getting the newest update. What we're actually finding now is software is one of the major drivers for obsolescence. A lot of the hardware, as new software programs are updated, just can't handle those. So for everyone to stay in with how things are going, be it mobile phones or computers, quite often they do need to update. I'd also say that some of the work that our project, funded by the European Union, will be looking to do is actually looking at some import standards as well, so that we could try to reduce that obsolescence, try and have Energy Star rating warranties that last longer and make sure that we're actually bringing in products into the islands that can last longer. And I guess TVs, fridges, white goods, those types of electronic as opposed to, computer type programs fit into that category really well. So making sure that we've got some durability in the materials that come into islands will be one of those key issues that we are trying to help countries think about and really consider whether or not they can make a change so that it's only quality items coming in. Obviously, there's socioeconomic factors there, but if we don't have to replace them as often and we start looking at the lifetime cost of products, it becomes a very different picture.
Now, perceived obsolescence is something that I'm definitely guilty of. But the thing is, here in Australia, when I'm changing my phone, my old phone, I can actually recycle it in mobile phone bins or what have you. But in the Pacific, these products actually become quite dangerous if they're just thrown away. Isn't that right?
Yeah, exactly. As I mentioned before, if they're left out in the elements or in fact put into landfill, those conditions do create leaching. So a landfill environment without air, with a lot of organic material, and it becomes acidic. As soon as heavy metals and the types of circuit boards and the like are put into those environments, they do start releasing those heavy metals, and they are some significant potential contaminants for water systems and land systems. So it's definitely not the preferred outcome. And as you mentioned, Australia has schemes set up that are government supported for the collection and the recovery of e-waste into the parts and the components that that then become commodities and can be reused, resaled, and built into new componentries. The islands, with the volumes that are created, they sound significant per person, but when you look at how many people live on an island, it's difficult to get economies of scale that you can generate in Australia and New Zealand, and then you have to ship it a significant amount of distance to actually get it to a point where that can be recovered. So the cost of recovery for the islands far exceeds the cost of recovery processes that that can happen in our metropolitan countries. One of the things that our project, PacWaste Plus, funded by the European Union, is looking to do is work with member countries on bringing in what's called a sustainable financing system. So in Australia, with the many nations or the states that are bringing in their container deposit legislation, we're looking at seeing whether there's a way that that type of mechanism can be used in the islands, i.e. you buy a mobile phone, there is a small fee attached to that that is held in trust, and then when that phone is recovered, the person who deposits that that phone back into that recycling system will get that deposit back, but a portion of those monies are withheld to pay for the dismantling and the shipping so that it is recovered and recycled. So trying to provide that monetary incentive and the legislative framework that will enable people to more readily access a recycling service and not have to put things into landfill is definitely one of the key opportunities that exists in region. And there's a number of countries, Samoa, Cook Islands, Solomon Islands and Vanuatu, are seriously looking at how this might work. And our project, as well as another one funded by the Global Environment Facility, managed by the United Nations Environment Programme, is looking to expend a significant amount of effort with those countries that are interested in exploring that opportunity.
And finally, Bradley, if there aren't places right now to recycle e-waste in the Pacific, what should people be doing with their old phone or their old laptop or tablet?
Many countries do have places to go, but unless you're in the know, it's difficult to work that out. So our advice would be, if you can store it somewhere in your house, do so. Try not to have it out in the open. Definitely don't just dump it out into the environment. Over the next year or two, as systems are established and partnerships with private industry are created, there will be a lot more opportunity for these activities to occur. One of the key things that we'll be talking to all of our countries about is, even if they don't have the ability to do collections of these things, to try to make available areas to drop off so they can be safely stored, to help with those economies of scale. Once there is a shipping container or two shipping containers, we have the ability then to start moving through and getting some of this material offsite. So the big thing is definitely not dumping. If you can store, please do. Landfilling is one of those things. It's a better option for the management of it, but it does create some significant issues. So the best thing is potentially even just go to your local retail outlet and see if they will actually take some of those back. And here in Samoa, one of the major electronic retailers is actually starting to do that now, entering into a private partnership with some companies in New Zealand and looking to create a bit of a take-back economy. So we'll start to see that type of industry-led action becoming much more prevalent through the countries as time goes on. And our hope is within the next 12 months we'll see a significant change in how the Pacific is able to more effectively manage e-waste that is brought in.
It's definitely something that we'll keep our eye on. Bradley, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
That was Bradley Nolan, Project Manager for Pack Waste Plus.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
I love my dog as much as I love you. The you may fade, my dog will always come through.
You've all heard the famous saying, dogs are a man's best friend, and I know my dog Aster is definitely mine. But dogs and animals aren't always well treated by everyone. Last year in the Northern Marianas, an incident where a dog was found with a knife embedded in its head put the spotlight on the fact that there weren't any animal rights protection laws in the Northern Marianas. In fact, it was the only US state or territory that didn't have any laws to protect domestic hated animals, but that's changed with new legislation passing this week. I caught up with Ed Probst, the CNMI congressman, who has been leading the charge to improve the way animals are treated in the Northern Marianas. Firstly, Representative Probst, congratulations on getting the animal rights bill through. I understand from when we spoke in 2019 and, you know, all the follow-ups that it's been a long time coming. How are you feeling?
I'm elated. I am just very pleased that it actually became law after so many attempts. It's really something to be very thankful for.
Now, I know yourself and your colleagues have been working on this for a really long time. How are your colleagues feeling?
I've spoken with my colleagues in the House and the Senate, and they were very pleased as well. It's been a long time coming, and it took a lot of work and compromise. We finally have some animal protection laws in the books, and now we have some protection for domesticated animals, and we are very pleased to see this. We've gotten a lot of calls and messages from a lot of friends and community members who are sending photos of their dogs and cats and animals, and they're just so happy that finally there's some laws that can help protect them.
So talking about the laws, what does this actually mean for the animals of CNMI moving forward?
For the first time, we actually have officers that will be in place to intervene in cases of torture or neglect of animals, which is something that couldn't happen before. In the past, I would sometimes get phone calls that from a constituent that would complain about a neighbor that was torturing or hurting and abusing their dog, for example. And I would ask, what can we do about this? And sadly, there really was nothing that could be done as we spoke to our legal counsels. And that was what was one of the reasons why we wanted to really push and ensure that this went through. Same goes for if a dog was tied up and neglected and not fed or didn't have any water, nothing could really be done to intervene. In these cases and in these situations, something can be done. This law is, again, it's the first of its kind for the CNMI. And as far as the research that we've looked at, we were at the time the only territory or state that didn't really have any such laws in its books. So it is monumental in that regard that finally something can be done in these situations.
And finally, Representative Ed Probst, what are your hopes that this might mean for animals in CNMI moving forward now?
What I hope is that we can have more responsible owners. We do have a lot of wonderful people, don't get me wrong, that take care of their pets, that do such a wonderful job in treating their animals just, you know, with love and care. But there are cases that we've experienced it has not been that sense. So we're hoping now that people can realize that, you know, that you need to treat these animals with the kindness and respect that one would hope for, and that they, you know, and that by doing so, it says a lot about who we are as a community.
That was a Representative Ed Probst speaking to me earlier.
Radio Australia now has a WhatsApp. Just add +61437519385 to your phone. It means you can message Radio Australia from anywhere in the Pacific. So add +61437519385 and send us a message. Tell us what you want to hear and join the conversations on Radio Australia.
That is all for the program. Keep listening to ABC Radio Australia across the day to make sure you follow and like the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page so you can ensure that you get the latest news and developments from around the region. We're also on Twitter at Radio Australia. That's where you'll find us if you want to tweet at us. And if you want to listen back to any of the stories today, including the interview we did on Pacifica mental health here in Australia with Giorgi Ravulo, you can head on over to our website. Just search ABC Pacific Beat into your preferred search engine and you'll be able to find us there. I'm Mala Damati. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful rest of your day.